hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the life I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life I'm fighting and falling down the key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, just as I was about to come on to start the program tonight, I saw somebody come across my email, and it was entitled Cortez. Actually, I'm going to be talking about Cortez later tonight, but a better one, Hernan Cortez, not New York City Bronx radical socialist congresswoman. What's her name? I was going to say Ambrosia, but I don't think it is. Anyway, Cortez. New York Congresswoman Cortez. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been selected to be on the House Finance Committee. Her credit score is 430, and two checking accounts have been forced closed. She's been evicted twice by sheriff's deputies. What could possibly go wrong? That they would appoint her to, that the Democratic Party would appoint her to this position. It's an insult to the committee, but it certainly says an awful lot about them. Whoa! Airlines in holding pattern on gender. What's this all about? Canada's largest airlines are awaiting details from the federal government before they follow their U.S. counterparts in allowing travelers to choose gender designations outside the traditional male and female check-in categories. Major airlines said last week they will change their ticketing
so passengers can identify themselves along non-binary lines, representing a victory for the transgender recognition. Now, non-binary, binary refers to two, you know, it's one or A or B, you know, male or female, up or down, and that's traditionally how we've done it. There's nothing particularly radical about the fact that we recognize, the Bible recognizes, that God created two genders. They may not recognize that in Germany. In Germany today, I think they recognize something like 57. But among people, at least on a good day, sane, it's recognized that they're just two genders. But no, to accommodate the transgender, the sexually seriously mixed up, and they constitute in a small percentage of the LGBTQ crowd. Now, they are generally considered to be about 1% of the population. That's those are the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer, or what? Don't ask me how queer might differ from homosexual, but anyway, the sexually mixed up crowd constitute about 1% of the population. The transgendered constitute a small fraction of them, probably maybe 10%. So we're talking about an infinitesimal portion of our population that we have to rewrite reality for. This change comes after a pair of major trade groups, the International Air Transport Association and the Airlines for America, approved updated standards to allow member airlines to offer two new gender options, unspecified or unidentified. Okay, so you can be male, yeah, that's good, or female, that's good too, or unspecified, you don't know, or unidentified. I can't tell, I don't know what I am. You know, why should we cater to mental illness? You know, this really is a problem. Now, if I wanted to be mischievous, and if this comes in, and I'm sure it will, and I want to put down my sex as just say unidentified, I think this might cause people, let's say security people, monitoring me at an airport or if I'm seeking admission to a country, to have some questions about me. Yeah, but unidentified, you mean he doesn't know what he is? He's clearly, from his appearance, a male. Well, what's the problem? I think you need to call attention to yourself, but it's just one more catering to minorities. In 2017, Ottawa announced that travelers will be able to specify their gender with an X on their passport instead of female or male. So you get three choices, three possibilities, M for male, F for female, or X, meaning, well, you don't know, you're screwed up or whatever. You know, I think that this should be treated with the absolute contempt that it deserves. Okay, well, enough of that. Devolution into the world of the weird. Well, thanks, Dan Hess, for sending this to me. This is a comedian who...
What's up, everybody? No live stream tonight. I'm just having
Who really has caused himself an awful lot of trouble. He's been terribly marginalized, but he really has something to say about, well, who rules us.
I'll be playing this weekend with Tommy Robinson in Manchester, England. The Bears and I were honored to write it to offer our support when he was imprisoned for a ridiculous situation. Stand by our guys. So this is the song, and if you're there, sing along with us. It's gonna be pretty epic. His new documentary, Taking Down the BBC, is gonna be incredible. So this is called Hallelujah, and these are the lyrics to this song. I heard there was a secret court where journalists weren't allowed to report, but you don't really care for freedom, do you? It goes like this: without the theft, the gavel falls and they cut your wrist. It's not okay that this is
the Tommy they're talking about is Tommy Robinson, a populist leader in Great Britain. Well, I was just reading, scanning just a little bit of the diary of Field Marshal Keitel. And he was one of those who was executed at Nuremberg. Keitel was a great German soldier and great commander. I was actually reading David Irving's introduction. He was summarizing about the first 30 years of General Keitel's diary, and before he would actually get into the bar, where he was translating the diary from about 1936 to the end of the Second World War. But one of the points he made was General Keitel's extreme modesty, that he would go to state funerals in the family Volkswagen, a very, very modest vehicle, particularly for a man of his stature, while others who are far less important would be tooling up in limousines. Well, I would say Canada's current defense minister, this guy with a turban, his name is Harjit Sajjan, might actually take a lesson from General Keitel. Defense Minister's photo tab hits $161,000. Photos! Yeah. Taxpayers spent
$161,000 for photographers to take pictures of Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan on his various trips in what the Liberal government says is proof that Canada is re-engaging on the world stage. That was one of the things, because Harper, I wouldn't say, was an isolationist exactly, but he wasn't big into the tossing foreign aid around and this type of thing. And so when the trust fund kid, Justin Trudeau, was elected in 2015, the message was, Canada is back on the world stage. Well, whether or not that's a good thing is a different matter, but you really have to spend $161,000 over several years to hire photographers to take pictures of just this one man? It would seem to me that could be done an awful lot less cheaply. Okay. That cost covers only covers only travel and accommodations for the military photographers and does not include their salaries. The amount covers 26 trips since late 2015 to locations such as India, Yellowknife, that's in Canada actually, Brussels, the Ukraine, Latvia, Iraq, and Africa. The photographers accompany the minister on the trips and are not assigned to specific military operations. The photographers, you mean his turban ship that leads the Canadian Armed Forces needs multiple photographers? Wouldn't one do? Canadian Forces stationed in the, stated in an email to the National Post that the photographers can travel at a moment's notice and have the security clearance necessary to take images of the minister at meetings with allies. Okay. So they're pretty important people, I guess. St. John's spokeswoman, Renee Filiatro, said in an email that such photographers are used by the military and the minister to support communications with the public in Canada and abroad. She noted that the minister travels to international meetings and to various missions. Well, yes, nobody would suggest that he shouldn't be photographed. But would it be really necessary? Don't forget, this isn't the salaries. This is just travel and accommodations to bring along multiple photographers. Some of the international meetings, of course, already have official photographers assigned to the events to produce imagery for the participants. So there's a real overlap here. The Department of National Defense did not have figures available on how much was spent on photography for previous defense ministers. I'll bet not. Questions about about official photography have been raised before. In August of 2016, CTV News revealed the government had spent $17,000 on photographing Environment Minister Catherine McKenna. She's a big supporter of carbon taxes and a great enemy of global warming. Oh, no, I'm sorry, now they call it climate change. Well, you can't lose on climate change. The climate's always changing. But she's a big control freak. But just to document her going from place to place, the government in just 1 year spent $17,000. That money was for photography for 15 events, including a conference in Vancouver, and the images were used by McKenna's department on social media channels, including Twitter. After the spending was revealed, McKenna acknowledged that the savings could be made. Quote, pictures are an important part of how we transmit our message, but we need to do it in a way that is mindful of the taxpayers. Well, yeah, and I think that's the point. Of course, yes. Nobody would begrudge a cabinet minister or a government official from documenting their attendance at events with photographs. Does it require official photographers? Does it require an entire staff? And for one minister, this is the Sikh who is in charge of defense over several years, $116,000, and it appears that much of this was, or much of the coverage could have been obtained for free or for very little, but because others were also covering these events. Today, today's the 19th, but today or yesterday, would be the 500th anniversary of an incredibly important historic event, and that was the setting out from Cuba by Hernan Cortes. Now, he was once, when I was as elementary school student in the late 1950s, we had popular songs that had been rewritten to provide us with a little bit of a summary of some of the things we were learning in history or social studies in grade 6. I remember one song, Cortez conquered all Mexico, Cortez conquered all Mexico, Cortez conquered all Mexico, fighting with might and with main. He said that he'd never seen anything sweeter than Mexico's treasures for Spaniards much meeter. And then to his war cry, St. James and St. Peter, he conquered an empire for Spain. You know, I remember, I think, almost exactly the lyrics. Well, of course, today, this would be considered, so politically incorrect. What did Cortez ever do? Well, he just destroyed this great Aztec civilization in Mexico, and he uprooted these, he devastated these poor people, all of it was motivated by vainglory and greed and so on. Well, I was actually quite surprised to see in today's National Post Peter Sean Taylor with a remarkably balanced discussion of Hernan Cortes. And Cortes led, and you have to remember this, he conquered Mexico, and the Aztec Empire, which constituted much of the middle part of Mexico, around Mexico City, and a couple hundred miles north and a couple hundred miles south. He conquered that with 650 Spaniards, 16 horses, some guns and some small cannon. There's considerable question as to how many people were in Mexico at the time. But probably something under 10 million. But when you think of it, he conquered it. These people had spears and knives and bows and arrows. It wasn't as though he was conquering a nation of crippled pygmies. This was an amazing military feat. And it wasn't the destruction of a wonderful, glorious, thriving civilization. It was the overthrow of an incredibly bloodthirsty, evil regime. Anyway, a lot can happen in 500 years. Sometime in mid-February 1519, half a millennium ago, most likely around February the 18th, around February the 18th, Spanish adventurer Hernan Cortes sailed from Cuba in 11 ships with 650 men, 16 horses, and a small army of nearly of early firepower. His goal, to discover a newer world, one richer and more rewarding in gold and glory than the new world of the Caribbean had proven to be for the early conquistadores. Yes, Columbus landed in 1492. It was now 17 years into the Spanish experience in the Caribbean, and it had been mixed, and the gold that they thought that they would find that would prove to be fairly well, there wasn't a lot of it. A week later, he set foot on Cozumel, Mexico, setting in motion events of continent-shattering consequence. 2 years later, by 1521, Cortes had comprehensively conquered the wealthy and sophisticated Aztec Empire. In doing so, he established the roadmap for subsequent European colonization of all North, Central, and South America. For his signature role in shaping our modern world, Cortes, once hailed by his peers as a great leader, that was the opinion of people at his time, is now widely regarded as a butcher and a madman. And he's figured in the Black Legend school of history that regards Spanish colonialism as a uniquely evil period. There was a 1975 movie by Neil Young, Cortes the Killer, and so on. The conquest of, is a very difficult topic for Mexico, admits Alicia Meyer, a historian at the National Autonomous University of Mexico and director of the school's Canadian campus in Gatineau, Quebec. For centuries, Cortes has been a very polemical historical figure. From a Black Legend point of view, he's a cruel, greedy murderer. Alternatively, Cortes' achievements have been regarded by other critics as preordained, and thus unworthy of special recognition. So the things he did achieve, they'd have occurred anyway, save these. Then they're usually just anti-white, white or self-hating whites. This line of thinking was popularized by the geographer Jared Diamond's 1997 bestseller, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which argues the advantages of horses, resistance to smallpox, and superior military technology allowed the European colonialists, beginning with Cortes, to conquer their Native American foes with unseemly ease. And you know, when you think about the huge disparity in numbers, you would think even suicide, frontal attacks, would overwhelm the relatively slow-firing Spanish muskets of the time. So it was the Cortes's absolute genius leadership, which we'll explore in a moment. Such is Cortes' reputation today that Meyer notes that there's scant official recognition of the quincentenary of his momentous arrival in Mexico. The past government of former President Enrique Peña Nieto had no program for Cortes, the historian says, although she notes the newly elected administration of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is making a modest effort at commemorating the event, and rightly so. There is, of course, a tension within Mexico. The elite have tended to be of Spanish descent, relatively unmixed. Then, of course, there were a fair number of Indians, various tribes in Mexico. Many remain relatively pure at the bottom. And then there's quite a number of mestizos. These are people of a mixed race. Well, as ideology has changed, the European factor is often very much denigrated instead of celebrated. Setting aside the question of whether it's better for historical figures these days to be reviled, dismissed, or ignored, the current state of Cortes' reputation is entirely undeserved. From an enlightened perspective, Cortes' personal accomplishments stand among the most remarkable and improbable in human history. His genius for leadership, adaptation, and tactical diplomacy may never be equaled, nor his resoluteness of purpose, nor is it his indomitability of spirit. And while there's no avoiding the many tragedies associated with European colonization of the Americas, by Cortes and others who came after him, his legacy also includes a rather modern concern for basic human rights of the indigenous population. He doesn't usually get credit for that. And I have temporarily lost my anyway, he doesn't get credit for that. At the time of Cortez's landing, the mighty Aztec Empire encompassed most of present-day central Mexico, comprising anywhere from 5 to 20 million people across hundreds of tribes within its epicenter of Tenochtitlan, a city of perhaps 250,000 located on the site of present-day Mexico City. And you can tell by the wildly between figures, between 5 and 20 million. I just think they don't know. But even if you take the lowest figure, to conquer 5 million people with 650 men is amazing. Cortez called Tenochtitlan the most beautiful city he'd ever seen, surpassing even the magnificence of Seville. Over this vast kingdom ruled Moctezuma the Second. Yet for all his power and wealth, Moctezuma sat on a flawed throne. Tenochtitlan was a warrior society dependent on tribute extracted from client states throughout Mexico on threat of military violence, leaving much of the countryside overtaxed and perpetually restive, wanting to rebel. His authority was also indivisibly linked to a religion requiring homage to various cruel and demanding gods and a calendar filled with portentous predictions. Without daily offerings of human hearts and blood, fresh blood, taken from still living sacrificial victims, Moctezuma and his priests believed their son would die. That is, in the heavens. Now, this was an immensely savage, evil religion based on huge expenditure of human blood, human sacrifices, and the hearts had to be ripped out of a living being. Now, this, of course, is not a pleasant fact for the multiculturalists and the egalitarians who always, of course, want to beat up on us. I don't care if some may say it's white supremacy. But surely, by any objective criteria, the religion of the Aztecs was bestial, demonic, and evil. And to overthrow such a regime would be a blessing to the Aztec people. Not saying Cortez came to Mexico with that goal specifically in mind. As far as we know, he didn't really know what there was in Mexico. And that is, of course, for historians, is a delightful teaser. Through native travelers, and there would be some travel across the Caribbean for between Cuba and Mexico, or some would Cortez have heard anything about Mexico? It's hard to know, but he certainly would not have had a very clear picture. The annual toll ran to 4,000 men, women, and children per year. That's the human sacrifice. Many of whom were ritualistically cannibalized, eaten. And so, before we say, what a great, great civilization was destroyed. Civilization based on mass bloody sacrifice of their own people and cannibalism? Not in my book. This was great. At ceremonies honoring the rain god Tlaloc, it was necessary to wet the ground with tears prior to the human sacrifice, usually children. Aztec priests would pull out their fingernails to make them cry. The victims of these bloody rituals were also extracted from the many tribes under the Tenochtitlan thumb. So, you know, they were ruling over other tribes and you basically using their people for human sacrifice. Wow! Cortes certainly had guns, horses, and other advantages of Western civilization, but he also had a great stroke of luck. In a striking coincidence, the Aztec legend of Quetzalcoatl predicted a pale-skinned god would one day return from the east to reclaim his lost throne. Cortes offered a passing resemblance, and the Aztecs' calendar recorded 1519 as Quetzalcoatl's year. But his success can't simply be ascribed to such factors, says Justin D. Lyons, a historian at Cedarville University, Ohio, and author of a recent book comparing Cortes with Alexander the Great. One of the reasons I compared him with Alexander was to reflect on his audacity in attacking such a massive empire with such slender resources, says Lyons in an interview. He was a very gifted commander who could size up situations very quickly and successfully navigate extremely difficult situations. The vast inequality of numbers, or iniquity of numbers, 650 Europeans versus millions of Aztecs, outweighed any advantage conferred by the Europeans' few horses and cumbersome guns. Of greater consequence, however, was the fact Aztec military tactics emphasized capturing their enemies alive for later sacrifice, rather than killing them on the battlefield. While hugely outnumbered, the more aggressive conquistadores thus had a superior game plan. Although given his slim resources, Cortes typically preferred bluffing to battle. Another a good quality, a good commander, attempts to avoid that. Better to outmaneuver or discourage the enemy than to actually contend on the field battle where there will always be casualties. Aided by native interpreters, Cortes quickly discerned the fault in Montezuma's empire and allied himself with tribes eager but unable on their own to overthrow Tenochtitlan's hegemony. In this way, he added hundreds of thousands of motivated warriors to his meager band of adventurers, and he carefully exploited the coincidences between his arrival and Quetzalcoatl's foretold return to sow doubt in his opponent's mind. So, discouraged the Aztec leadership and gained himself highly motivated soldiers to augment his own, people who wanted to be free of the tyranny of the Aztec Empire. So despite the sophistication of Aztec society and politics, Cortes outmatched Montezuma on his home turf in diplomacy, tactics, and intelligence gathering. In fact, the ruler's reaction to Cortes's slow but steady march to Tenochtitlan roughly conforms with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. Moctezuma variously tried to ignore the invaders, dissuade them, bribe them with gold to get them to leave, and then ambush and kill them. When nothing worked, he fell into a depression that allowed Cortes to walk into the great city unopposed. If Moctezuma had been more energetic and determined, he could have easily pushed Cortes back into the sea, reflects Lyons, a historian. Beyond strategic concerns, Cortes was constantly beset by rivalries and dissensions within his own small force. As a self-appointed leader of a rather unruly band of soldiers, Cortes had the impossible task of balancing tough discipline with popular support. When the full scope of the mighty Aztec Empire came into focus, many of his crew wanted to flee back to Cuba. Here's the personal leadership of Cortes comes in. It was his force of personality that carried the day when cowards or whatever wanted to go back to the relative safety of Cuba. In response, Cortes famously destroyed his boats on the beach at Veracruz, giving his men no choice but to join his quest. After narrowly avoiding an assassination attempt, Cortes uncovered a list of the conspirators. Realizing he couldn't afford to punish them all, since they comprised a large portion of his senior staff, Cortes claimed the ringleader, whom he hanged, and had swallowed the list before being captured. This deception, this is really clever, this deception allowed him to keep track of those whose loyalty was suspect and who were on their best behavior, therefore, thereafter, while avoiding a major bloodletting within his own ranks. You see, he knew that there was a number of his senior people had conspired against him. Now, he could kill them all. He could have them all executed, but that he would thereby gut much of his senior leadership. And, you know, every Spaniard killed would be one fewer of a small band to conquer Mexico. So he couldn't afford to be decimating his own ranks. And so he seized upon this very clever ruse of executing the leader and saying that he had swallowed the list of other conspirators. So he knew who they were, but they didn't know whether he knew. And so they were on their best behavior. And this is, you know, immensely clever. And when the governor of Cuba attempted to recall Cortes by sending another fleet to bring him back in chains, he raced from Tenochtitlan to the coast, defeated his rival in a lightning strike, and convinced the rest of the newly arrived troops to join his mission. Whatever the challenge or obstacle, Cortes found a way to overcome it. As for the scourge of smallpox, it didn't make an appearance in Mexico until 1520, after Cortes had seized Tenochtitlan for the first time. And when it did arrive, it hit Cortes's native allies as hard as his enemies. In truth, it was Cortes's daring leadership skills and unerring sense of opportunity, not guns, germs, and steel, or luck, that made him so successful in the face of such slim odds. In British historian Hugh Thomas's memorable turn of phrase, Cortes had that capacity of all successful men of being able to conceal his real intentions until the pair which he coveted was ready to fall. Most importantly, he never ever gave up. When a series of reversals saw his men expelled from Tenochtitlan, losing most of their guns in the process, Cortes rallied to take the city a second time, this time at sword point. What drove Cortes to take such risks? The common explanation for the Spanish conquest is God, glory, and gold, in ascending order of importance. But while gold was certainly a key motivator, it can't explain the entirety of Cortes's actions, in particular his concern for the lives of those suffering under Aztec rule. Cortes was sincerely opposed to human sacrifice, both personally and due to his religious creed, says Lyons, he's a professor in Ohio, noting that Aztec religiosity involved a level of slaughter that's probably never been equaled in the world prior to the event of mechanized means. When Cortes's party entered Tenochtitlan for the first time, they reported seeing racks displaying tens of thousands of skulls from sacrificial victims. Racks displaying tens of thousands of skulls. Now, this was a profoundly evil regime. And these claims are being recently backed up by archaeological evidence. We don't rely just on what you might dismiss as the, you know, exaggerated accounts by Cortes. In fact, this is being archaeologically verified. A single festival during the reign of Moctezuma's predecessor consumed an estimated 80,000 lives. One festival. The ritualized killing and cannibalism of its subject people appears to have been the central preoccupation of Aztec leadership, and Cortes went to great lengths to stamp out these horrors, even when doing so ran counter to the demands of glory and gold. He outraged crucial native allies, for example, by destroying their altars and interrupting sacrificial ceremonies when a lesser and greedier man might have looked the other way.
Although this is written something of somewhat of an apology, I still think it's immensely encouraging. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side. I mean, go and take my musical interlude right now. I find this is a really inspirational song. Wait a second. Oh, I haven't lost it here. This is with Whispering Bill Anderson, a key figure in the country and western music for many, many decades. Hope I can get it up here. I thought it was there, but yeah. I wonder if God likes country music. Whispering Bill Anderson.
We've talked a lot today about our friends at the Grand Ole Opry as we salute the Grand Ole Opry on Country's Family Reunion. I don't think anybody has mentioned the name of Roy Acuff, but I want to do that because some of my greatest memories of being on the Opry were the nights that Mr. Roy would come out on the stage and allow me to share the spotlight with him and do this song right here. I got a lot of wonderful memories. If we have time, I'll share some of you, but first I'd like to do the song, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope maybe you remember. One night we were out on tour getting ready to do a show. And at the time, it really wasn't anything all that special. It was what you might call just another one-night stand. When I looked over my guitar, and there stood an old man. His cowboy clothes were frayed and worn, and his roots were far from new. He said, "I'd like to sit in with your band." He said, "I'm a country singer too." We just all had a big laugh. When I looked back at the old man, there was a tear in his eye. So I told the band to cool, because I didn't want to see him cry. He reached down and he took my guitar. With a determined look on his face. But then as he started to play and sing, a look of sadness took its place. He said, "I've sang my songs from Maine to California. Sing the world through the window of a car. I never made a dime back when I made it, never saved a dime. I always thought someday I'd be a star. But now my voice is cracked and no one wants me. My wife gave up on me years ago. It's been so long, my kid don't even know me. And picking and singing is the only life I know." And then he said,
"I wonder if God likes country music. Will there be a place up there to sing my song? Will he make my fingers nimble like
just stood there. None of us really knew what to say. He took my old guitar and he sat it down ever so gently. And then as he turned to leave, the band stood up with applause. But I can still hear his words today.
I wonder if God likes country music. Will there be a place up there to sing my song? Will he make my fingers nimble like they used to be?
And that's Whispering Bill Anderson. I wonder.
Thank you, Bill.
God loves country music. Oh, that's a great song. This is a song with Gene Watson and lovely Rhonda Vincent. Nothing Sure Looked Good on You. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
Style, he lured you, and you
to nothing. Nothing should look good on you. Oh, when we were down to nothing.
Here's a great country and western duo, Keith Whitley and Lori Morgan, till a tear becomes a rose. Keith died all too young.
Darling, I can see the clouds around you, and in your heart I know a sorrow.
Back of the game tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern time. Show's repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. I sum up tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada.
The Maple Leaf Shore from Britain's shore. Would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless.